Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Wednesday, February 5th, and we are continuing our conversations this week on the seventh commandment. You shall not steal. What does this mean? We should fear and love God so that we do not take our neighbor's money or possessions or get them in any dishonest way, but help him to improve and protect his possessions and income. So our conversations will stem from that as well, be related to that. How does this commandment intersect with our daily lives and shape our worldview? We're going to talk with some great guests. We'll talk with Tim Gegline here in just a minute, a former deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President George W. Bush, and also author of The Man in the Middle from B&H Publishing. We'll talk with him in just a little bit and hear his story. And then coming up in the second segment, we're going to talk with our friends from Lutheran Housing Support about some of the projects that they're working on to support our neighbors as well. So I hope you can stick around for all these conversations. It's going to be an enlightening and just a great conversation today. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting the program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org, look for the sponsor section, and find their CUW logo in the sponsor section there. Click on that. That'll take you to their page, and you can find out all about the great programs they have to offer and where they're located. Our listener lines are open today, 1-800-730-2727 or 314-821-0850. Or you can email your questions to family@kfuo.org, and we'd be happy to take some questions during our conversations today as well. Joining us by phone today, author and former deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President George Bush, Tim Gegline. Good morning, Tim. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Andy, and good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. I so appreciate it, and it's great to be here. I must say that in my iteration as one of the vice presidents at Focus on the Family, we have so appreciated everything that KFUO stands for and has stood for all of these years, and it's really an honor and a joy to be with you this morning.
Thanks so much for being our guest. I know you're a busy man. You've got a lot going on these days. So, but I've read your story, and I think it's a great story to share. I shouldn't say it ends because your story hasn't ended yet. But the key thing that comes up in this story is redemption, and I want to get to that forgiveness. Tell us, Tim, about your formative years that led up to your career in the White House.
Well, as I say in the book, Andy, I was born and raised in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was raised in a very loving and close family with a large extended family. I am a cradle Lutheran. That was our faith was always very central in my growing up. And I had a very happy childhood. And I knew, even from the time that I was a young boy, that my vocation would be journalism. I absolutely then and now love the intersection of politics, the press, and public policy. And when I was a junior in college at Indiana University in Bloomington, a friend of mine asked if I would apply to become an intern in the U.S. Senate here in Washington. And I said, yes, I would, and I did. I did apply and became an intern that summer for then U.S. Senator Dan Quayle. And I enjoyed it so much that the following summer, I became an intern again in Washington in the House of Representatives, and then I interned on the weekends here in Washington at NBC News. So it was a wonderful experience in my growing up, and by the time that I was nearing my graduation at Indiana University, I found myself on a trajectory of politics, journalism, the media, the press, public policy, having no idea that I would come back to Washington. Professionally, but that's where my life was going, and it was a wonderful experience.
And where along the line did the Gegline family begin? Where did your family? Where did Mrs. Gegline and the rest of the family become a part of the picture?
Well, you're so wonderful to ask. The most important thing in my life is my faith in Jesus Christ. And as a result of my faith, God brought into my world the most important person in my world, who is my wife, Jenny, of 22 years. And we've been blessed with two teenage boys, Tim and Paul. And we had a wonderful wedding. We've had a wonderful married life. After I spent a year working as an executive producer at one of the NBC affiliates, I was then offered a job to be the press secretary in the United States Senate for Dan Coats. We moved our family to Washington, it's hard to believe, 25 years ago. And we have had a wonderful life living and working here in Washington. But needless to say, for all the things that we believe in, family, marriage, parenting, it's a very rough and tough time.
When so you have a family, you have this strong faith, as you said, a cradle Lutheran. You were raised in this one true faith, and you find yourself in Washington. What does that mean? What does your worldview mean for you in your work in Washington, coming in as a Lutheran with this worldview and stepping into this vocation, into this work that you have in Washington? What did that mean for you?
Yes, I'm thrilled that you asked, Andy, because for all those years, which was a lot of years, 10 years, working in the U.S. Senate, I always believed that my vocation was to serve God first, to serve other people second, and to serve myself last. And I really believe that. I believe that that was the way to navigate forward in life. But as I say in my book, The Man in the Middle, the seeds of pride get planted here and there. And if a person is not mindful of how those seeds are planted, it cannot end well. And for some people, the avenue of pride is sex. For other people, it's power. For other people, it's money. For me, it was wanting to be the clever one, the one who said it or spoke it, read it, wrote it better than anybody else. And regardless of whether I was a great reader or a great writer or a great communicator, it wasn't good enough just to be good. I had to be the best and I had to be excellent each and every time. And of course, that is a prideful high bar, and that is never the expectation in our faith. And after Dan Coats retired from the Senate, I went to work for George W. Bush. I became a special assistant to the president and the deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. And I had a commissioned role as an officer to the president, and it was an extraordinary run. The late, great William F. Buckley, who was a very good friend of mine, once said to me, "It's a remarkable thing to be speaking and to see that the President of the United States is taking notes." And that really should have been a sign to me, because my pride was growing in this regard. And as I denote in the book, I came back from a breakfast at the White House to my office, and because of my own sinful pride, because of my own fault, my world literally began to cave in.
And I want to get to that moment here in just a little bit. Tell us, I want to hear more about your career in the White House. Obviously, I'm sure you met a lot of people. What was the day-to-day like in your career? Because you were there, seven and a half years, I believe?
Yes, exactly. I was there for almost two full terms. I'm told that in dog years, that's about 1,000 years. But yeah, and it's very unusual for a commissioned officer to the President of the United States to actually be at the White House that long, because it's high pressure, it's high stress, it's long days. But I can honestly say, Andy, if I were a billionaire, you know, I would have done it for free. That's really how much I loved working for President Bush and how much I loved my position. I was a special assistant and the deputy director of public liaison, which is a fancy way of saying that I was the point man for the President of the United States with all my fellow men and women of faith, with my fellow conservatives, with veterans groups and cultural groups. It was quite a run. And because I worked very closely with Karl Rove, and because Karl Rove, and I say this with great humility and in friendship, but Carl and I became very good friends and colleagues, and he allowed me, and he did not need to allow this, but he allowed close proximity and regular proximity to the president. And Karl Rove is a really great friend and was a remarkable colleague. And in fact, he's written the foreword to this book. And so I got to know President Bush, and I got to work with him very closely. And it was extraordinary. My job was to make sure that people outside the White House knew exactly what the president was doing and why he was doing it. And my job equally was to make sure that I was accurately reflecting back into the White House bloodstream what was being discussed and talked about outside the White House. So it was a wonderful role. It was a role of external relations, really, and has translated beautifully into my work at Focus on the Family, which I love.
And you mentioned earlier that there was an event that changed your career. There was a pivotal moment that everything changed. You had this wonderful career doing all the things you love. You have a great family, lots of colleagues, a great congregation and pastor. Just a good life. You're living the good life, right?
You know, I have to say that I really was. I said earlier in the interview that if I were a billionaire, it's the thing that I would have done for free. it was very tough. It was very demanding. It was all those things. But it was a position that was really tailor-made for me. But when someone is prideful, the large amounts of self-deception can be a part of the equation. And I came back, as I recount in my memoir, from a breakfast at the White House, and I popped open my email, and a reporter asked me point blank, did you plagiarize this column? And what she was referring to was a column that I had been writing for my hometown newspaper for many years, not about politics, but about all the other things that I love in life. Music and sports and philosophy and the fine arts and culture, et cetera, et cetera. And as I recount in the book, Andy, I literally fell down next to my desk and I prayed, oh God, because I knew it was true. Hmm. I had extraordinary colleagues and they wanted to understand this. They were shocked and saddened and disappointed. But I made the decision that day to resign my position, and I wrote a letter to the president, and I resigned on that Friday, and I left the White House in utter and total disgrace. And I came in on Monday to begin cleaning out my desk and taking the pictures off the wall of my office at the White House, and as I recount in the book, the chief of staff said that the president wanted to speak to me. He actually said, the boss wants to see you, and that's White House speak. If it's good news, it's that the president wants to see you. If it's bad news, it's the boss wants to see you. And I was expecting what I deserved, which was my total and complete woodshed moment. Mm-hmm. And as I recount in the book, I got to the Oval Office, and something rather extraordinary happened.
And did you expect? You expected to be... what kind of response did you expect from the president?
Well, here's what I would say. In the political classes, whether you work for a governor or a president or a senator, when you embarrass the president or the senator or the governor, a kind of divorce takes place. You are immediately persona non grata. And that's what I expected my fate to be. And I expected to have my woodshed moment with the president and potentially other senior aides, to be read the riot act and to, you know, and to leave the White House once and for all in disgrace. Mm-hmm. What I found instead was rather amazing, because I got to the Oval Office. It was just the president and me. And I turned to the president to apologize. I looked him right in the eyes and I was prepared to offer my apology. And before I could get a few words out, he looked back at me and he said, you're forgiven. Hmm. And I was beyond stunned. I was so stunned that I was speechless. And I tried to regain my composure. And I said to the president, sir, and I was preparing to apologize a second time. And he looked at me again and he said, you know, Tim, grace and mercy are real. And I have known grace and mercy in my life. And I'm extending them to you. You're forgiven. And as I tried a second time to regain my composure and was able to apologize categorically, I mean, what had happened was there were no extenuating circumstances. It was not anybody's fault. It was my fault, categorically, without exception. No excuses. And I apologized to the president. And he responded to me by saying, I'm going to say again, you're forgiven. Grace and mercy are real. Now, we can talk about all of this, or we can talk about the last nearly 8 years. And so I turned to sit on the couch in the Oval Office. He said, no, sit over here. And he directed me toward the chair, really of honor, where the vice president or head of state sits when they come to the Oval Office, beneath the famous portrait of George Washington. And we sat there and talked about the last 8 years. And we prayed together. And I turned, as I say in the book, to leave the Oval Office, knowing that that would be the last time I would see the president in the Oval Office ever again. And he said to me, I want you to bring your wife and children here next week so that I can tell them what a really wonderful husband and father you've been. And I just have to tell you, Andy, I'm a grown man, but I was beyond choked up. I mean, the leader of the free world, it's not in his job description to validate a person who has, fallen and screwed up so badly as I had. It's not his job to validate that person before wife and kids. But that's exactly what George W. Bush did. And I recount the rest of the story, and we've become good friends, and I've seen the president many times. And this has never been mentioned again. And I tell this because for all the things that all of us read about and hear about and think about it when it comes to American politics and this intersection of faith and public life, it is extraordinary to know that it's not a theoretical or philosophical discussion with me, that in my experience I've really experienced the most remarkable form of grace imaginable from the most powerful man on planet Earth.
I'm sure we're overwhelmed by that, to receive that forgiveness right then and there.
May I tell you, Andy, I was not only overwhelmed, I was overwhelmed then and now. It's kind of like a car accident. The car accident happens, and you don't begin to really feel badly sometimes until, a few hours or a day later. The further I get from this, not the closer, but the further I get from it and really stand back and think about it, it's a remarkable moment of grace, probably the most important one, this side of eternity, this side of providence that I've ever experienced. And I can only conclude that the grace and mercy and the love and the compassion that was extended to me at the worst possible moment of my life came about because George W. Bush is a serious Christian. Because he had experienced the love and mercy and forgiveness of Jesus Christ in his own life, and if I may say, when he found this moment in my own brokenness and in the midst of a very severe crisis, he didn't turn and go down the other side, of the proverbial Jericho highway. He came, and in the absolute best and most immediate sense, he ministered to me at that moment where I needed it most, and I am still dazzled and humbled, deeply humbled by what happened.
Where did you go from there? Obviously, family, colleagues. How did those conversations go?
Well, may I say that the brokenness and the crisis which followed was the worst of my life. Cardinal Newman, the late John Henry Newman, famously said that the definition of a gentleman is that a gentleman never inflicts pain. And clearly, I had inflicted pain on those I loved and who believed in me most. My wonderful wife and my children, my parents, who all these years later remain my best friends. 20 years of interns through both the Senate and the White House. My own mentors and people who I looked up to and who helped me along the way. I mean, I felt, Andy, that I had let everybody down. And yet I can say that people came to me and ministered to me when I least deserved it. I learned, Andy, there are two kinds of crises. One is the kind when a tornado hits your house and you have no say-so in the matter. That was not my experience. The kind of crisis was self-made, self-inflicted, and I learned firsthand that as a result of my utter and complete sin, that I hurt other people, the most important people in my life, very, very deeply.
How does the forgiveness that you received from those around you, including the president, how does that experience and shape your day-to-day work now in what you do as Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family?
It teaches me, and I'm so glad that you asked this question, it teaches me every day that you can never, ever, ever get to the bottom of the grace and the mercy and the love and the compassion and the forgiveness of Jesus Christ. I like other people, when I'm driving my car, I'll drive past a church, and some of these churches have little sayings on their front sign. It's meant to be, a gesture of thought. And I remember seeing one of these signs a couple of years ago, and it said that at the end of your rope, there is not nothing, that at the end of your rope, there is Jesus Christ. That meant a lot to me. It seems trite and maybe cliched or something, but I'm sure there are thousands of people listening who have been in crises, maybe not of the kind that I'm describing, but other things. And this kind of thing does two things. It makes you love and find precious the reality of the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, but it also pushes you over the line from the ability to sympathize, which is maybe you haven't had an experience, but you can sympathize, but it pushes you over to the line of empathy, which is that you have been through it yourself. And it has allowed me in a very, very deep and personal way to empathize with those who have gone through a crisis because I myself have been through one.
We've been talking with Tim Gegline. He's Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family and former Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President George W. Bush and author of The Man in the Middle from B&H Publishing. If you want to hear the rest of the story, you got to get the book. Tim, thanks so much for being our guest today. We really appreciate your time.
Andy, I so appreciate it. And I wanted to mention very quickly, if I may, and very quickly too, I promise, that Focus on the Family is embarking on a major project called the Family Project. You're going to hear a lot about it. I recommend people go to our website because the Family Project is going to be very big in the years ahead.
Thanks so much, Tim.
God's, be of good cheer.
God's
Thank
blessings.
You. And to you.
Coming up in the next segment, we're going to talk with our friends from Lutheran Housing Support about some of the projects that they're working on and the history of Lutheran Housing Support. Stick around.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
People who follow New York politics know Governor Andrew Cuomo is radically pro-abortion. Recently, while being interviewed on radio, Cuomo railed against pro-lifers and others who disagree with him, saying they should be banished. The governor said, and I quote, "They have no place in the state of New York." And then the mayor of New York City chimed in, saying he totally agreed with the governor. Evidently, these politicians think the state is theirs to do with as they see fit. Radical pro-abortion people have no concern for the Constitution or the rights of others. It makes me wonder, if they had their way, would we be dragged off to concentration camps? America is involved in a culture war, and if we don't fight back, radical politicians might get their way.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Vocation, vocation, occupation. What are the differences between those three? A lot of people think that occupation and vocation are the same thing, but they are not. On the next Law and Gospel, which is an insight item, we're going to be taking a look at what a vocation truly is.
Weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
Let Worldwide KFUO help you get the word out about your next church, school, or organization event. By including your event in the KFUO datebook, it will be announced on the air throughout the day. Send your event information via email to jennyw@kfuo.org. That's jennyw@kfuo.org. Or call 314-996-1515. Be sure to include date, time, location, and contact information. The KFUO datebook is a public service of listener-supported Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Hi, I'm Pastor Ted Lesh, pastor at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in North St. Louis County, inviting you to listen to our KFUO radio worship broadcasts on Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock. Active worship, preaching, music, and singing are part of every one of our services at Chapel. Join us Sunday nights at 6. It's one more broadcast worship opportunity for you from your friends at Chapel of the Cross and KFUO Radio.
Bill Nye, the science guy and the founder of the Creation Museum, have debated whether evolution or the Bible better explains how everything began. Nye said it takes magical thinking to believe the universe was created in 6 days only 6,000 years ago.
We have rocks with rubidium and strontium and uranium and potassium argon dating that are far, far, far older than you claim the Earth is.
Creationist Ken Ham responded,
"All such dating methods are fallible, and I claim there's only one infallible dating method. It's a witness who was there, who knows everything, who told us. And that's from the Word of God."
Nye said the Bible's not a science book.
Please, you don't want to raise a generation of science students who don't understand how we know our place in the cosmos, our place in space, who don't understand natural law.
But Ham said believers in evolution don't allow other views to be taught.
They're imposing their ideology on the students, that everything's explained by natural processes. That is a religion.
I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Wednesday, February 5th, and we are reflecting on the seventh commandment this week, and what a great story that was of redemption after dealing with the seventh commandment, then hearing that redemption that Tim experienced. Great story and encouraging. And now it's time to move on to our next segment, our next topic. We have guests in the studio today joining us from Lutheran Housing Support. We have Fred Kimbrough, National Projects Director from Lutheran Housing Support. Fred, good to have you in studio today.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
And also joining us here, James Kinker, Director of Advancement from Lutheran Housing Support. It's good to have you here today, James.
Thanks, Andy.
So you guys work right down the hall, don't you? Are you guys here on the third floor as well? Lots of important things happen on the third floor here at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Mm-hmm. And I would be sorely mistaken if I failed to mention Nicole, what is her official title?
CEO
of Lutheran Housing Support, who helped coordinate for today as well. She's part of the deployed staff, so she's out and about working on a number of projects today. But Lutheran Housing Support, hear those words and I wonder, what does that mean? What is Lutheran Housing Support? Who wants to take that?
I can take that, Andy. Lutheran Housing Support, our official name is actually the LCMS National Housing Support Corporation. And we are the primary arm of the church that's responsible for working with congregations, districts, and our recognized service organizations mm-hmm. to provide community development and housing, neighborhood revitalization services to communities surrounding LCMS altars. We do business as Lutheran Housing Support, and I think a lot of our LCMS kind of stakeholders know us as Lutheran Housing Support. And we were really built on a 150-year history inside the Synod that has focused on mercy and caring for the communities around our LCMS altars. As far back as the 1860s, our church was building orphanages and hospitals and homes for the elderly. And up into the 1960s and 1970s, the Synod made a very big push in the area of fair housing, which today would be kind of considered affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And that led to the creation of the Keys for Christ program, which eventually yielded about $60 million in affordable housing and homes for about 10,000 families.
Wow.
And then the proceeds from that were then reinvested in the Nehemiah Project in Brooklyn, New York in mm-hmm. the 1980s, yielding another 3,000 units of homes. And over the 90s and into the 2000s, that position, we've had a housing manager position inside World Leaf for Human Care and the Board for Human Care. And in the last about 10 years, that has been kind of coalesced inside the LCMS National Housing Support Corporation.
So you have quite a history, and, mm-hmm. and it all comes back to mercy, mm-hmm. is what I'm hearing you say. That it all comes back. We can provide all kinds of support. We can provide housing and other things, but what lies behind it is mercy that then brings us to, as you said, built around LCMS altars, built around mm-hmm. the body of Christ and the gifts mm-hmm. that he gives us in word and sacrament ministry. Mm-hmm. What I'm curious, now each of you have different titles. Fred, as National Projects Director, what do you work on primarily?
Well, I am charged with the responsibility, Andy, of initiating the projects. So when we decide that we want to initiate something, and primarily our the thing that starts that is the needs around the church in the neighborhoods that surround them. And so in this particular instance, our biggest project, which is in College Hill here in St. Louis, St. Paul's Church helped initiate this situation back around 2006. Actually, James's mm-hmm. mother was the first executive director of Lutheran Housing Support. And so out of her work, an interest came in the College Hill neighborhood, number one, to help support and stabilize the church, but then also to continue to stabilize and build the community. And so out of that effort, there were different areas that were identified, and this was a community-driven effort. And so different areas were identified. One of the things was creating a safe neighborhood, providing after-school activities, vocational opportunities, health and nutrition. And then the things that really brought us into the neighborhood were rehabilitating existing structures and then creating new home ownership opportunities. And so initially, when we got started in the neighborhood, we focused on rehabilitation. Up until this date, we have rehabilitated major to minor 71 units of housing in that community, which is a lot.
Wow.
In a short time frame. And so also, in addition to that, we did some neighborhood organizing. We have Don Strohmeyer, who is our community organizer, and we helped start something called the Campaign for College Hill, which is a way for the residents to come together and articulate in a formal way issues and then look to take some action in conjunction with other organizations, social service agencies, and the city, and to just bring those things to light, mm-hmm. because if you're unorganized in a lot of the neighborhoods, that happens so much every place, it's hard to get traction mm-hmm. to deal with problems. And so now we're moving into a phase of new construction. And so we got a lot of exposure last year, our organization, in College Hill, because we started building units. Mm-hmm. We have a plan to develop 20 units of housing. Right now we have built two, so we are off to a pretty good start. We should be coming up on our first closing in March, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
And part of the goal, what we're trying to do is bring back this neighborhood in such a manner where we bring in strong working class and middle class families. And so we're trying to target not just a lot of times when you do inner city development, you receive a lot of funding through the city, mm-hmm. via through the federal government, and you're restricted to the income levels. You have to normally operate at 80% or below. Well, in this case, because we haven't received those types of dollars for the most part, we're able to open it up. So now we can bring back the teachers, the policemen, the mm-hmm. firemen. Matter of fact, the lady, the first purchaser, Ms. Connor, she's actually a city employee. So this is working exactly like we anticipated up until this point. And we still have a long way to go. But
you mentioned that this is when you approach a project like this, it's community driven. Mm-hmm. Why is it important that it be community driven and not just someone else? The Lutherans are coming in and taking over our neighborhood.
You hit it right on the head. What happens a lot of times in community development, when neighborhoods and communities view the outsiders, quote unquote, to just come in and tell me what to do, they don't really mm-hmm. like that. And so it's better to build a consensus from the residents, because ultimately they live there. Mm-hmm. We're coming in to help, but mm-hmm. it's still their neighborhood. When we leave, it's their neighborhood. And so it's important to have their buy-in into the development of the projects and their input, mm-hmm. because they, you know, if they say that they don't want something and we put it there,
sure,
we're going to drive away all our support.
Right.
And so I think that's why it's very important to actually have them involved from the beginning.
And how do you determine where you're going to do your next project? Where are you going to do your next work?
Well, it's driven actually by the churches, by the LCMS churches. We are contacted constantly mm-hmm. about potential projects. Mm-hmm. I was actually just speaking to a gentleman that represented a church out in California this morning. I met with some pastors that happened to be in town last week, and they're in Texas. And so they articulate, you know, their needs, you know, and then we kind of go through our checklist to kind of see mm-hmm. how viable something is. Everything always revolves around funding.
Sure.
So what's the potential for us to put this together? What resources are there in the church? Mm-hmm. What resources are there via the city? And what type of fundraising opportunities potentially lie there? And so those are some of the considerations that we take. Just, you know, it's normal development. It's like any real estate developer, but we're doing it from a nonprofit driven mm-hmm. fashion.
And Fred mentioned the key word there, funding. So, James, I'm going to guess that's your department.
Yes, it is my department. Yes, as Director of Advancement, my primary focus is bringing in resources, both internal and external. Mm-hmm. In our corporation, we have kind of the benefit of being able to go out and get a lot of external funds that can supplement our Lutheran dollars. And we regularly go out and we work with banks and we work with foundations and also government programs as well to just see what is out there that can supplement mm-hmm. work that our congregations already want to do in the field. And it kind of helps leverage a lot of different pools of money as well. And one of the things that our corporation is also tasked with is just spreading the word about housing, community development inside the church. And we do a lot in terms of trying to raise awareness about community development efforts in different cities and in different congregations. And we raise resources for that among LCMS donors and among other external funders as well. One of our key service areas is actually providing access to capital. We have two major kind of service areas, access to capital and customized consulting services or technical assistance. Mm-hmm. Access to capital is really in that area of what resources are out there. A lot of congregations want to do work like this. I mean, as a Christian, you just are thrilled to be of service to your neighbor. It's just an outgrowth of faith. But a lot of times they don't have the technical expertise within the congregation, be it fundraising or be it community development. And so Fred is and Nicole both kind of come in there from the community development angle. And, you know, how do we put something like this together? How do we build this project and make it in such a way that it is something that's palatable to an external funder?
Sure.
And then I work in from that funding side, and we have a multitude of resources on our end that can help us identify and research and find those resources in the community. But we always are working in support of the local congregation. It is their vision, and it's in supplement to their word and sacrament ministry. And so we do not come. In fact, our work in College Hill was started in part by St. Paul Lutheran Church down there in College Hill, and they've been there for 100. They just celebrated their 150th anniversary this year. And it's those kind of congregations where they look out beyond their doors and they see a community that's suffering, and it looks very different from when that church was founded. And they're like, how can we help? And that's kind of where we come in. We're a resource for them, both on the, you know, the fundraising side as well as the expertise side, the community development side.
And one of the things that we do as well is we provide technical assistance training for pastors and other members that are parts of the congregation. That's something that we implemented last year that started off very well. And so one of the things that we did, we went to Fort Wayne, Indiana last year, in conjunction with NeighborWorks, who is a major community development training organization. And we provided training at the seminary for how many people did we have last year?
That was about 30.
About 30 people.
Wow.
And so we've also done, and then we did some things online training with some pastors last year. Pastor Quinn Paulson, who used to work here in the building, he helped orchestrate that. And so we trained probably about 15 pastors and church members, and there were a couple of other trainings. And so that's something else that we're trying to do, because there's always a question, well, what is community development? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And so what we try to do is actually break that down into the different components, because there's different types of community development. There's community development that revolves around housing, but then there's community development that revolves around economic development. Then there's community development that revolves around education. So it can go in a lot of different directions, although our primary focus is housing. When we don't actually have a strength in the area, that's when we try to engage and bring in other partners from different providers of services in the communities.
What are some of the communities, what are some of the success stories? What are the stories that that make you want to get up and come into work every day?
Well, and I'm going to speak to right now, because we're putting so much emphasis on College Hill.
Yeah, sure.
That's a natural place to go for me. When I go into the neighborhood, and when I drive up in the morning on the job site, and all, in addition to that, we also had a big hand in building the houses last year from Laborers for Christ. They came out, and I don't know if everybody's familiar with Laborers, but they kind of function as the Lutheran version of Habitat for Humanity workers. And these, a lot of these gentlemen are retired, and they like to spend their time helping to rebuild churches and homes and doing all that type of work within the church. And so when we get out on the job site and I'm driving up and people from the neighborhood are walking, and they're waving at me, and they're telling us how great a job we're doing and how proud they are. Because in this particular neighborhood, a lot of promises were made through the years by a lot of different people, political people to others. And one thing that they have constantly told us is that you all kept your word and you all did what you said you were going to do. And so that is, I mean, that makes me very proud. You know, President Harrison was there at the groundbreaking as well as at the ribbon cutting.
And
like he said,
yeah,
you know, we'll work with anybody. We, you know, if they are for uplifting this community, that's great. And so, you know, the mayor's there, and that's another partnership that has developed out of this. We are getting tremendous support through the city of St. Louis in a neighborhood that is not the best neighborhood and has had a lot of issues. And so making those connections and bringing all these different resources into what has been an area that's been deprived of that, that makes me very proud. I'm happy to be a part of that.
I remember seeing that last year when President Harrison was there. I think it was last year, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And thinking, wow, I didn't even realize we did work like this. This is right. This is great. Mm-hmm. To see a neighborhood that is really being transformed in many ways, and so much involvement from people who live there in the neighborhood. What are some of the other cities or other places that there are projects that have been successful?
Well, we work in just across the country, and we actually still have a very strong presence in New York with the Nehemiah Project, which is, I believe, now into Spring Creek, which is another kind of community in the New York area. They're continuing to put up thousands of units of housing out there. That's just an incredible kind of success story with the Atlanta District President, David Binky, and he's on our board as our vice chair. And we work in Milwaukee and Fort Wayne and just kind of in different areas. Mm-hmm. We also provide a lot of grants as well. We've provided about $1.2 million in the last 6 years in emergency grants, domestic grants, feasibility studies. And that's kind of laying the groundwork for the future, you know, especially the feasibility studies. We have a lot of congregations that, you know, they've gotten to the point where they've looked at kind of their surrounding community and they know that there's a housing need there, but they don't quite know what that next step is. And so they can apply to us for a feasibility study grant, and that's about $5,000. And they can hire someone to come in and do a market analysis and take a look and see what, in more of tangible, rock-solid terms, you know, what are the needs and what is potentially kind of market-ready in there. And we've provided those kind of across the board. One of the neat – we do servant event grants as well for housing, and I ended up receiving a note in the mail from a high school girl up in Michigan who had kind of participated in one of the servant event grants that we had given out, and this church up there had provided I think it might be up in Cairo, Michigan. I think it's St. Paul, and we've provided them I think two or three grants over the time. They go out and they do this, you know, servant event, and they have 50 or 60 kids go out there and they fix up an elderly person's home or something along those lines. And this note was just thanking us for providing that grant. And it's like, well, we should be thanking you. I mean, you're going out there and doing this incredible work. And it's just kind of stuff like that, including our work in College Hill, where that is very rewarding. And but we have a lot of kind of lines out there.
And so, for example, last year, visited Kansas City to work with the Pastor Dunn, actually going back up there and taking Pastor Dwight Dickinson, taking him up there to look at some of the work in Pastor Dunn's neighborhood, because they have he has a similar project that he's interested in initiating in St. Louis. We're also starting a new project over in East St. Louis, Illinois, with Unity Lutheran. And so we have, but the thing about this type of work is very developmental.
Sure.
It's a lot of baby steps. So you can't always take off very fast, but you have to start laying the groundwork. And with College Hill, that took, you know, 6-7 years to actually get up and running to the point to where we are now. And so it's, you have to show patience.
It takes a lot of patience, I'm sure, because these aren't things that happen overnight.
Correct.
To revitalize neighborhoods and communities takes a long time and a lot of partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, as you both have mentioned, there are a lot of partnerships along the way to partnering with the community, to partnering with those who help fund and finding funds for these projects and these opportunities. I want to give a chance to talk about some of the upcoming things. I know I just saw the press release about the grant cycle. Mm-hmm. Would you like to share a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, I'll jump in on James's territory. We had a really nice end of the year. We were awarded a major grant from Wells Fargo last year, the Urban Lift Program. Mm-hmm. Once again, that is a grant that is going to help in College Hill, where it's actually helping with acquisition and demolition of property. So once again, we're continuing to work in that particular part of the world. But then also, James, would you like to tell them about the other one that we were awarded?
Which one?
That's right.
So many.
No, that's right. That means times are good. CDFI.
Yeah, the CDFI. We've also received a grant from the Department of the Treasury to actually prepare ourselves to become a community development financial institution or kind of go down that path to look at what's available there. And if we're able to get certification in that area, that will bring even more resources to our projects. But in relation to your grant application, yes, those are now live. We have an open grant round that is open through April 15th in domestic grants, feasibility study grants, and servant event grants. The caps for those are $10,000 for domestic grants, $5,000 for a feasibility study grant, and $3,000 for the servant event grants. And those just went live, I believe, Monday, and they're open through the 15th, tax day. anyone who wants to learn more about that can go to our website, www.nationalhousingsupport.org. And if they want to learn more about our work, including upcoming projects, we are always pushing new content up there and new news. We just released our annual report for the last fiscal year, so that's up there. If people want to learn about any of the 30 or so project partners that we've worked with over the last year in terms of congregations and districts and RSOs and kind of get a glimpse at that work and what's been done, that's also up there as well. Just coming down the line, we encourage congregations to reach out to us. They can find that contact information on the website.
And we'll link to that today as well with the archive of the archive of the show as well.
Just have a conversation with us. I mean, if you're just even if you're at kind of that initial stage of we're not sure if housing is where we want to go. We have connections with we work very closely with the Office of National Mission with Pastor Carlos Hernandez and his Gospel Seeds program, which is a really great kind of a feasibility type program where it gets the congregation out into the community and looking around and seeing what those needs are and talking with residents. And so even at that early stage, we'll sometimes kind of call Pastor Carlos in or Nicole or Fred will talk and see what kind of opportunities are there from a community development standpoint, or I may end up having a conversation if it's a fundraising type of question.
Sure.
So we're always available, always open to any kind of inquiry.
Well, we've been talking with Fred Kimbrough, National Projects Director for Lutheran Housing Support, and James Kinker, Director of Advancement for Lutheran Housing Support here at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Fred, great to have you in studio today.
Thank you.
And James, thanks for being our guest today.
Eddie.
God's blessings to you and all the work that you guys are doing. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Eddie. Have a good one.
Coming up in just a little bit, we've got Moments of Assurance for you right here on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.